All right. Good afternoon. Welcome to this IIEP International Economic Policy Forum. In just about 1 minute, I'll be introducing today's distinguished speaker, Dr. Stephen Radelet, who is the chief economist of the U.S. Agency for International Development. IIEP, the Institute for International Economic Policy here at the Elliott School at George Washington University, works in three main fields: international development economics and poverty alleviation, international trade, and international finance. We have four now signature initiatives, with a fourth just being launched this week. Our three initiatives have been adaptation to climate change in low-income countries, ultra-poverty and inequality, and China's economic development and U.S.-China economic relations. We had our two-day international conference on economics of adaptation to climate change last May. That will all shortly be online. Already you'll find all of the papers online, and we'll have some follow-up activities and publications on that over the course of this academic year. With respect to China-U.S., we will be having our fourth annual conference on China's economic development and U.S.-China economic relations here in this room all day on September 23. With respect to poverty, all day on September 30, on the seventh floor, we will have our conference on the increase in food prices and its impacts on the poor. And on March 22 and 23 next year, we'll have our international conference on ultra-poverty. This week, we are launching our fourth IIEP initiative on global economic governance for the 21st century. And our launch event will be this Wednesday at 11:30, when Robert Zoellick, the president of the World Bank, will be speaking here on campus. And you can find the details on this and many other events on our website, gw.edu/IIEP. And now it's my great pleasure to introduce today's speaker, Dr. Stephen Radelet, chief economist for the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, as we often call it. During 2010, Steve was senior advisor for the development for the Secretary of State, where he advised on best practices in development and strategies to strengthen and elevate development across the U.S. government. From 2002 to 2010, Steve was senior fellow at the Center for Global Development, where his work focused on economic growth, poverty reduction, foreign aid, debt, and trade, and where, among other things, he was known as the leading expert on the MCC, the Millennium Challenge Corporation, I would say the leading expert on this in the world. From 2000 to 2002, he was Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Treasury. From 1990 to 2000, he was a fellow at the Harvard Institute for International Development, where he directed the macroeconomics program and was a lecturer on economics and public policy there at Harvard, where he also received his PhD in public policy. Dr. Radelet has also served as an advisor in Liberia, Indonesia, and the Gambia. Dr. Radelet is the author of many publications, including his newest fascinating book, Emerging Africa, How 17 Countries Are Leading the Way, which just came out at the end of last year, and that will be the subject of his talk today. So Dr. Radelet, welcome to the George Washington University.
Thank you. Thanks, everybody. It's great to be here. Thanks for that kind introduction. You'd make my mother blush. It's very nice to hear all these kind words. I'm going to talk to you a little bit about Africa today. I'm an economist, so I apologize for those of you. How many people are economists or aspiring economists? See, there's only a few people. There's probably more, but they don't want to actually admit in public. But, you know, economists have a particular perspective on the world, which I think is illustrated by following story. There's a man walking down a country road one day, beautiful country road, dirt road, stone walls, and open pastures and trees, beautiful day. And he's walking along, and he comes along a shepherd underneath the tree, and there's a big flock of sheep out there behind him. So he sits down under the tree and starts talking with the shepherd. They have a very nice conversation. And after a while, the man says, "I'm a wagering man. I'll make you a bet." He says, "You got a great flock out there. I bet I can tell you exactly how many sheep you have in your flock, and I'll bet you $200 against one of your sheep. If I guess right, you give me a sheep. If I guess wrong, we'll give you $200. And the shepherd thinks, well, this will be the easiest $200 I've ever made. Go, yeah, we're on. So the man looks out in the field. He looks around behind the trees, and he says, you have 187 sheep. And the shepherd is absolutely amazed. He says, I can't believe it. You got that exactly right. I don't believe it. Go ahead. You take one of my sheep. So the man reaches over, grabs the nearest animal, throws it over his shoulder, starts walking away. And the shepherd watches him, gets a little bit of a quizzical look, and says, hang on a minute, double or nothing, that I can tell you exactly what you do for your job. Guy says, yeah, I haven't said anything. Yeah, double or nothing. I haven't said anything to tell you what I do. He says, you're an economist. He says, you're an economist probably for the federal government. The guy is absolutely amazed. He says, how did you know that? He says, put down my dog and I'll tell you. So, economists are pretty good at some things and not so good at other things. And certain perspectives we have are helpful and other perspectives are not. So, with that, I will launch into this talk, which is about economics, but also about politics and institutions and development more broadly. I'm here to talk about sub-Saharan Africa. And I want to start by asking you, just very quickly, word association. When I say sub-Saharan Africa, what is the first thing that comes to mind? Quick. Poverty. What else?
War.
War.
AIDS.
AIDS.
Corruption.
Corruption. Anybody want to say giraffes, maybe, or something? Game parks, something that's a little... It's negative, and that's not... that's not saying anything for you. That's the popular perception about sub-Saharan Africa. War, disease, poverty, incompetence, corruption, dictatorships, it's all negative. And I want to challenge that. But I don't want to challenge that in a way that is pie in the sky that says everything is great in sub-Saharan Africa and they're just misunderstood. I don't want to suggest that, a few people suggest that there's a massive turnaround across sub-Saharan Africa and all is well, but nor do I want to suggest that all is bad in sub-Saharan Africa. In fact, what I want to do is try to push you to not think about sub-Saharan Africa as if it was a singular entity that you could describe as either going well or not going well. We have a bad habit, we in the development community, of making broad characterizations about sub-Saharan Africa that we don't do so much in other regions. I lived in Indonesia for 4 years in the early 90s, and I lived in Africa in the 80s, and then I lived in Indonesia, and I was struck in Indonesia, which is in the middle of the East Asian boom at the time, before the crisis, that when people talked about the Asian miracle, no one was pretending to talk about Asia as a whole. They were recognizing that they were at first four countries in Asia, the four tigers, that then expanded to 8 or 10. And even today, people who talk about Asia don't make the mistake of putting all countries together. But in Africa, we do. I hear all the time, well, you know, yes, Ghana's elections have gone well, but Kenya's didn't, and so I don't really think that democracy is going to take off in sub-Saharan Africa. Or, yeah, Mozambique has done really well economically over the last 15 years, but the Central African Republic is still a mess, so Africa is not turning around. And you never in Asia, anyone ever says, you know, Indonesia's doing great, but Papua New Guinea next door is a mess. Or Thailand has done really well, but Burma is a disaster, and so this Asian miracle stuff doesn't make sense. Or South Korea is a miracle, but North Korea is not, and what we ought to do is average them together, as if that would make any sense. It doesn't make any sense at all. But we do that in sub-Saharan Africa. So I want to push against that. Now, I think there are reasons why we have negative perceptions about sub-Saharan Africa. And actually, 20 years ago, it would have been a lot harder for me to suggest that, well, we got to make these big distinctions across sub-Saharan Africa. Because I think 20 years ago, I think it was actually broadly true, with only a couple of exceptions, that both economically and politically, sub-Saharan Africa was really in a messy situation and things were not going very well. In 1989, as we'll look at in a minute, there were only three democracies in sub-Saharan Africa, and the economic trends were really bad across the board except for in Botswana and Mauritius. We're really the only two exceptions. And so there are reasons why people have these perceptions that for a long period of time things were not going well. But in the mid-1990s, since the mid-1990s, the single biggest pattern in sub-Saharan Africa is actually a divergence of economic performance and political systems, a divergence where about half of the continent actually still suffers from many of the old problems of dictatorship, economic stagnation, poor governance. And those are the countries we read about in the newspapers every day, whether it's Somalia or Zimbabwe or Sudan or the Central African Republic or Equatorial Guinea or lots of places, or Kenya when the elections go poorly. But another almost half, and 17 countries that I'll talk about plus six more that I call the threshold countries, have actually changed course since the mid-1990s, both economically and politically. And since it's good news and almost and rather moderate good news, modest good news, you never read about it in the newspapers, because modest good news sustained over 10 or 15 years doesn't make the newspapers. To get the newspapers, you either have to be an extraordinary miracle or you have to be a disaster. But countries that have turned the corner and are doing many things well, you don't hear about. And that's what I want to focus on here today. So my disclaimer is that I wrote this book before I joined the U.S. government, and my lawyers tell me that I have to say that everything I say here does not reflect the views of USAID or the Department of State or the U.S. government. So, having done that. Okay, this is the usual starting point for discussions about economics in sub-Saharan Africa. This is the median income across all countries from 1960 until 2008. And what you'll read by many analysts is that what this shows is that with all of the work in sub-Saharan Africa, there's been no change in income over 40 or 50 years. In fact, I took this I recreated this based on a graph that Bill Easterly had written, had put in a paper in the Journal of Economic Perspectives, that basically that was the conclusion, that over 40 plus years, not much had changed in sub-Saharan Africa. Bill's a good friend. We debate all the time. This is not a picture of no change. This is a picture of three very distinct changes. The first, from 1960 until the mid-1970s, is a period of moderate economic growth. And we won't go into the details of that, but it was concentrated in about a dozen countries or so, or a few more. This is around the period of the end of colonialization and a lot of optimism that Africa was going to do well because of the end of the colonial system and new independence era. There's a great deal of optimism. That all came to a halt in the mid-70s. With a combination of two things. Politically, a lot of the post-independence leaders moved into different variations of dictatorship, strong, weak, some strong, some weak, but moved away from really any forms of democracy, and political systems and accountability began to crumble as a result. But economically, this, of course, was when the whole global economy was hit badly by the oil price shocks of the mid-70s, and there was a widespread global recession. Every country around the world, including the United States, was hit very badly, and there was a long period of economic decline. It turned out to be much worse and much longer in sub-Saharan Africa, partly as a result of the nature of the shock, partly as a result that, frankly, they didn't respond very well in terms of economic policies. And that led to the second phase here, which is 20 years of marked decline in incomes, not just stagnation, decline in incomes, in the median income across the continent. And if we disaggregated and looked, you know, for country, you'd see a few exceptions, as I say, Mauritius and Botswana, that were, you know, above the line and doing well, but very few countries where this trend was even flat, much less positive. Almost all countries, the median income was falling over this 20-year period. 20 years is a long time. And this is where we have the perceptions that still hold today about the negative economic performance across sub-Saharan Africa, rising debt, and all that goes with that. But that ended in 1995. And since 1995, you have even faster growth rate than in the first period. And a major reversal now, this only goes out to 2008, but even with the financial crisis, if we go out to 2010, that continues to go up. So things have changed. Now, to the extent that people look at this a little bit, most commentators will say, well, it happens because of oil prices and other commodity prices. But as we'll see, oil prices and commodity prices actually didn't start going up until about 2002. And this recovery was well underway by that point. So there's three different phases here. But I don't want to portray that all is well in this third phase, because if you think about it for a minute, there's a bunch of countries in sub-Saharan Africa that you can think of very quickly that don't follow that pattern. Right? This is not Zimbabwe, and this is certainly not Somalia, and this is certainly not the Central African Republic or a bunch of other countries. So there's this big turnaround, but we could all list a bunch of countries where that's not what we think is really going on. And so that suggests very quickly, as soon as you think about this, that there must be some countries that are even doing better if there are countries that are even doing worse. And that is, in fact, what's happening. So what I do in this book is divide the countries of sub-Saharan Africa into three main groups and one small subgroup to try to explain some of these patterns that I'll look into. One is oil exporters. Oil exporters have a whole different political and economic dynamic behind them. And when you average their performance in with a bunch of other countries, it really affects the averages. And of course, their economic prospects are largely driven by world oil prices. So these are the oil exporters in sub-Saharan Africa. And some of them have had quite strong growth rates, even Sudan and Chad and Equatorial Guinea at 23.6% growth rates sustained over 13 years, which, you know, if you're averaging growth rates, that looks terrific. It's actually a disaster for Equatorial Guinea. It's a very small country. They found a lot of oil, and it's a deeply, deeply, deeply corrupt place. So the economic indicators can be quite misleading. As most of you know, the story of Dutch disease and everything else, whatever you think about the economic prospects of the other countries, the economic prospects and dynamics in oil exporters are quite different from everybody else. So without prejudging what those would be, I just separate those out, recognizing that they are different in many ways. The other countries I split into two categories by one criterion, whether their per capita growth rate since 1996 exceeds 2% per capita or not. That's it. And I have this list of countries, all of them exceed 2%. I did bend the rules slightly for my friends in Zambia because there was one year in 1999 where they had a particularly bad year. Otherwise, they would have done it. So they certainly had 10 years over 2%. So I did actually shade a little bit for Zambia. But if you cut me that little bit of slack, all the others are above 2%. So these columns, I'll talk about these in a second, but these columns are just two economic criteria. You're either an oil exporter or not, and your per capita growth rate is over 2% or not. That's it. So so these countries are the focus of my the book here, alongside these as well. It turns out that that distinction leads you to seeing this great divergence of both economic and political performance. I'll talk about politics more later, but I was stunned when I looked at this list, defined by two economic criteria, that of those 17 countries, 14 of them are democracies. Okay? I didn't set it up that way, but they are. All of them, and I'll talk about my definition of democracy in a few minutes, all except for Ethiopia, Rwanda, and Uganda pass tests in terms of at least being a weak democracy, if not a strong democracy. So that foreshadows one of the major points I'm going to make, which is the strong overlap in sub-Saharan Africa since the mid-90s of economic performance and political change. That's a very different narrative than East Asia 20 years ago, when the miracle countries were not democracies at all. 20 years ago, the story in East Asia was that if you wanted to do well economically, you needed a benign dictator. You needed Lee Kuan Yew in Singapore. You needed Suharto in Indonesia, who was sort of benign, at least on the economic side. You needed the strong generals in South Korea. There was not a democracy story. 20 years ago, you could not find strong democracies among developing countries that had performed well outside of Mauritius and Botswana. India was the big democracy and one of the few at the time, and its economic performance was hardly outstanding. So 20 years ago, the major development story was democracies didn't do very well, benign dictators did. The story in sub-Saharan Africa over the last 15 years is completely different. And that's one of the main points that I want to get into.
So these are my 17 countries. These are the others. These are the oil exporters. There are six countries that I put into threshold status, and I do that for a reason. I'm going to talk a lot about why 1995, 96, but I wanted to convey that this is not a stagnant group. It's actually continuing to grow. And here are some countries that I think could be added to that list. I don't count them because their economic performance has not been sustained for this long. I really wanted to highlight the importance of sustained economic performance. Kenya, Liberia, Sierra Leone showing good signs of being on this track, but not for so long. Their turnarounds are more recent. Benin, Mali, Malawi, Senegal, three other noteworthy countries, but they don't achieve the 2% yet. But it's just a point to make that this is not a stagnant group. Cote d'Ivoire maybe will be joining this group soon, but it's not a stagnant group. But the point, the criterion again is the growth rate, but it's the growth rate sustained over a reasonable period of time. And those of you who have thought much or studied much about development know it's all about sustaining progress. In some ways, 12, 13, 15 years is not that long, but it's a big change, and it's a turning point from what there was in the past. So those are my three groups of countries. Here's where they are. They're just shaded. You can see a lot heavy concentration. The blue are the emerging countries in Southern Africa, and there's a reason for that, which I'll talk about, up East Africa, but some now on in West Africa as well. So they're spread out reasonably well, but not many in the center part of the continent and not really too many landlocked countries. Okay, this is the same graph as this one, but now split into my three groups. And if you remember, you had the trend up and then the trend down and then the trend back up again. And when you break it up like this, you can begin to see some of the patterns. All of these groups had declining incomes in the 20-year period. It looks like these guys are flat. In fact, they were. But that's because of Mauritius and Botswana. Actually, if you take out those two countries, the blue line would be more or less following this downward negative trajectory. But since 1995, here's what we see. The emerging countries have really taken off in terms of their income growth. The oil exporters kind of fluctuated around, but since 2002 have taken off as oil prices have risen. And the other countries have continued this downward stagnation in terms of their income, which again is what defines our perceptions of most of sub-Saharan Africa. And the truth is that for half the continent, these negative trends politically and economically continue, but not for the whole continent. And so you have this divergence of income per capita. And I'll just flip through some slides here quickly to show that it's not just about income, it's actually about a bunch of other indicators, both economic and social, where you see this divergence. These are the growth rates, so that's really the same thing. This is investment, gross capital formation. You can see the divergence there. Here's total trade. Here's productivity growth, which in 1995, all of a sudden, a big change where the emerging countries had zero or negative productivity growth. And since then, they've had about 2% productivity growth, where the rest of the continent has, a subcontinent has largely been negative productivity growth. Here's agricultural production, which diverged a little earlier, starting in about 1990, but a big divergence in agricultural production. Here's infant mortality, where the story is a little different, but really quite good. Infant mortality is a key health indicator. Here you actually have, across the subcontinent, very good news. Infant mortality rates are the lowest in the emerging countries. They're higher in the other countries, but they are declining in the other countries. So there is a bit more of a widespread good news story here on health. And for people who argue that there's been no progress in sub-Saharan Africa over the last 30 years, this is one of the strongest indicators to suggest, no, whatever you believe about the income numbers, this is a really important number. And across the continent, you have this huge progress. And I want to underline that this is huge. Infant mortality is measured by the number of deaths, number of children who die before their first birthday out of 1,000. Okay? So in the emerging country group in 1980, about 93 out of 1,000 kids died before their first birthday. Absolutely unacceptable, a tragedy that we cannot even imagine. Okay? 30 years later, that number is down to about 65 here. Today it's probably about 63. So today 63 out of 1,000 kids die.
still totally unacceptable and a tragedy that just should not happen. But
the change in just 30 years, which in development is nothing, to go from 93 kids to 63 kids
is huge, because there's 30 more out of every 1,000 that today are alive that would have been dead. And if that pattern can be continued, you have a major, major transformation in terms of health outcomes. There's a lot of reasons for this that we can talk about in terms of technologies, of immunization, of oral rehydration, lots of other things going on there, but there's a huge success across the continent. Primary school enrollment rates are largely similar up across the continent, but particularly high in the emerging countries. So the news is good, not just on the economics, but some of these social indicators as well. Here's one that really surprised me. This is population growth rates. Population growth rates in the emerging countries were bouncing along at 2.5%, and in 1995, all of a sudden, they started dropping. And now they're down to about 2%. Again, high, but something changed here at the same time as these economic indicators turned around. For those of you that are demographers, it's too early to say exactly what this means. Maybe this is the beginning of a demographic transformation. Maybe not. But I was stunned, actually, to see that that change happened in exactly the same year that the economic stuff started to turn around. Now, a lot of people ask, well, it's nice to have those economic growth rates and those income growth rates, but what about the poverty numbers? Here are the poverty numbers, headcount index, in the emerging countries in $1.25 a day. And in 1993, it was about 59% was the headcount index, and today it's down to about, well, in 2005 it was down to 48%, an 11 percentage point drop. These are still the most recent numbers that the World Bank has published, but I'm quite certain that that number will be lower, even with the impacts of the financial crisis, which we'll talk about. But in 12 years, the average headcount poverty index dropped 11 percentage points. That's huge, actually. That's a really big drop. When you start getting a percentage point a year fall in a poverty index and you can sustain it over time, you really are in the beginning of the road to reducing poverty. So we have this drop in poverty, but the economic growth rates, again, these I used 2% as the minimum.
All of these have exceeded 2% per capita. The average is actually 3.2% per capita growth, 3.2% sustained here over 13 years. What that translates to is that the average income in these countries has increased by 50%, real terms, since the mid-90s. 50% increase in average income in these countries since the mid-90s. That's a big change. That's what 3% on average per capita growth can do if you begin to sustain it for 13, 14, 15 years. You get a 50% increase in real incomes. There's 300 million people in these countries. Some of them are small, but some of them are large. But that's 5% of the world's population. So we have this segment of 5% of the world's population that has increased their incomes by 50% in the last 15 years. Most of them are democracies. And most people in the world don't know this is going on. So that is the pattern of what's been going on. A lot of people want to portray this as mostly commodity prices. Well, sub-Saharan Africa, some of these countries have been doing well because commodity prices are doing better. This is the terms of trade index, which is a ratio of your export prices to your import prices. So when you're seeing a commodity boom, this ratio goes up because your export prices are rising faster than your import prices. If you're facing an import shock, like an oil price shock, these go the other way. So if it's an export boom that's driving this turnaround, you would expect that you would see a big change here. 1995, this is when the economic turnaround started. Actually, the terms of trade was still working against these countries. It wasn't until a few years ago that commodity prices started to go up. So just looking at this, it's very hard to make the case that commodity prices in 1995 are what were really at the basis of driving this turnaround. They've contributed in some countries, but this is not a commodity boom. And so the thesis of my book is that there are five deep fundamental changes underway in these countries, in these 17 emerging countries that are not particularly widely recognized. And the book goes through all five of these, a chapter on each of these.
The first is the rise of democracy and improved governance that goes with it. We'll talk about that in a minute. Second is stronger economic policies, where economic policies today, far from perfect, but they are a whole lot better than they were 20 years ago, and I'll talk briefly about that. Third, the end of the debt crisis and improved donor relationships. Basically, the story here is that as the debt burdens increased and countries were forced to go to the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank and essentially lost control of economic policies over their countries, which might not have been a bad thing, all told, because their economic policies had not been very good, but they lost sovereignty, economic sovereignty, which in the long run is not a good thing. As the debt crisis abated, essentially they've been able to regain that economic sovereignty, and today the IMF plays a much smaller role than it did 15, 10, even 5 years ago, but certainly 15 years ago, and that's led to an entirely different dynamic with the international community, where instead of IMF programs being the centerpiece of discussions, country-driven poverty reduction strategies are at the core. So I'll talk about that in a few minutes. The rise of new technologies, not so much the turnaround in 1995, but driving it since then. The rise of cell phones and the internet are creating huge new economic and political opportunities. And finally, the emergence of a new generation of leaders, political leaders, business leaders, NGO leaders, local community leaders, youth group leaders, where there's a whole generational change. So let me talk very briefly about each of these and then open it up for questions. I'm going to talk mostly about the first two. This is a graph showing the number of African democracies based on two criteria, Freedom House indicators and something called the Polity 4 score out of the University of Maryland. The Freedom House is a measure of political rights. The other measure is one of institutions around elections and parliament and other kinds of institutions of restraint. Two different measures, independent measures of democracy. Using those definitions over time, in 1989 there were 3 democracies in sub-Saharan Africa. Today there are 22. This is a really huge change. Now, these democracies are weak, they're imperfect, there's still corruption, there's presidents who go for their third term and sometimes their fourth term. They're not perfect. But no democracies are perfect, and we'll talk about that a little bit as well. But this would have seemed impossible in the late 80s. The prevailing view in the late 80s was, as I said earlier, to be successful, the developing country needed to be a benign dictator, but it was stronger than that. That really, it was not really feasible for really poor countries to become democracies. Under sort of the prevailing view, a very simplistic version of the modernization theory, poor countries really don't become democracies. It just doesn't happen. What we have seen in sub-Saharan Africa over the last 20 years is the largest movement towards democracy ever recorded in history amongst low-income countries. This has never happened before, to have so many low-income countries shift towards democracy in so short a time. It has never happened before. It's happening right under our noses, and most people are missing it. And it should not, therefore, be a surprise that a lot of these democracies are struggling, they've got issues, they're weak, they're far from perfect, and I'm not talking about Washington, D.C., I'm actually talking about African countries. But, you know, we have a little bit of a struggling democracy ourselves. So it's not too surprising that they're imperfect, but this is a huge turnaround. What happened here is these are the scores, and I won't go into the score. Well, let me just stick with this. What happened here is two things began to make this push. Why? What happened? Both internal pressures and external pressures. Internally, that 20-year decline in economic performance and political stagnation began to really run its course. And at this point, you had a lot of bankrupt countries where dictators, frankly, could no longer afford the patronage systems that had kept them in power. They were running out of money. They were bankrupt, they couldn't borrow any more money, and it was very hard for them to finance the army, to finance the civil service, to finance huge subsidies, to finance all the other things that kept them in power. So you have dictators beginning to lose power, and you have more and more voices in sub-Saharan Africa starting to speak out very loudly about the really poor economic performance after 20 years. The oil export, the oil crisis of the mid-70s that had driven a global crisis, most countries in the world had turned around by then, but by the late 80s, not in sub-Saharan Africa. So you're seeing louder and louder voices in terms of economic unhappiness and dictators that are losing their ability to pay for it. But then externally, you had the end of the Cold War. This does not happen without the end of the Cold War, because broadly you have the fall of the Soviet Union, the calming down of fighting between the Soviet Union and the United States, and our bidding to get governments in sub-Saharan Africa to do what we wanted or do what they wanted, on the one hand. But on the other hand, you also had globally a decline in the credibility of the strongest forms of socialist systems, whether economic socialism or political socialism. And I don't mean mild socialism. I mean the strongest forms of economic socialism or communism. At this point, it's not working. And you have voices, obviously, in Eastern Europe that are saying economically and politically those systems don't work. There's a rise in voices in sub-Saharan Africa at the same time that says, the guys who invented communism and socialism are throwing it out. What are we doing still following this stuff? It's not working here in sub-Saharan Africa. So you see calls for political change in parallel with economic change as the Cold War is coming to an end. And then the other big factor that changed here is the end of apartheid. The end of apartheid drives this system and leads to some economic instability in the early 90s, but then stability leading into the mid-90s. And the end of the apartheid system and the emergence of a democracy in sub-Saharan Africa is absolutely at the core of the turnaround that we're seeing in parts of sub-Saharan Africa. It's absolutely at the core. And South Africa remains central to the future prospects of these countries. South Africa is enormously important, both economically and politically, in this story. Here's how those two things, the Cold War and the apartheid, came together, and they were absolutely intertwined. This goes up to four in 1989. That's Namibia. In 1989, Namibia ended a long civil war where Namibia had been known as Southwest Africa. Time. It had been not quite an independent country. It had been under a League of Nations mandate administered by South Africa, and then when the League of Nations changed to the United Nations under a UN mandate. But the UN tried to take that mandate away from South Africa in the late 50s and early 60s. South Africa said, forget it, we're staying here, and started to put troops into Southwest Africa. And that led to the rise of a rebel group called SWAPO, the Southwest African People's Organization, and a long civil war, where we ended up having SWAPO, based out of Angola, fighting in Namibia with Cuban troops. Cuban troops financed by the Soviet Union, fighting against South African troops financed by, well, that would be us. This is where my disclaimer about the U.S. government comes into play. But this is the Cold War meets apartheid. Head on, in military guerrilla battles in what is now Namibia. And in Mozambique, by the way, on the other side of South Africa, similar thing going on. As the Soviet Union begins to fall apart and Gorbachev makes moves towards openness, this feeds into this conflict. And in 1989, a negotiation is held, led by Chet Crocker, former Assistant Secretary of State. And they come up with this deal and lead to parliamentary elections in November of 1989. Those elections were over 5 days, November 9th through the 13th of November 1989. So November 9th is the turning point, beginning of the turning point. November 10th, 1989, is the day that the Berlin Wall fell. So these are not sort of distantly proximate. This were happening exactly the same time. 6 weeks after this, Nelson Mandela is released from jail. A couple years later, he's elected president, and the turnaround is underway. So this story is very much a Cold War apartheid story. Now, the beginnings of democracy, it's not just elections. It's a much broader definition of democracy. You have big declines in conflict in the emerging countries, not so in the rest of sub-Saharan Africa, but big decline in conflict, big change in how African leaders come and leave power. This is a nice graph put together by Daniel Posner and Daniel Young about how African leaders depart from power. And the dotted line is the percentage of the changes that come through coups, violent overthrows, or assassinations. The solid line is change of power through losing an election, through voluntary resignation,
or natural death. And in the 60s and 70s, 75% of changes in political power in Africa were through violence, were through political overthrow, coups, or assassination. Only 25% were elections, natural death, or resignation. And elections weren't very many of those. It was mostly natural death. Today, this has completely flipped. And coups and assassinations still happen occasionally, but they are much rarer in sub-Saharan Africa. And most changes of power are through elections. Some of those elections aren't very good, but at least they are not through coups or assassination to the extent that they were. The democracy extends to governance. And there's a lot of numbers here, but this is actually a rather important chart. Because a lot of people think, well, they've just had elections, it's not really democracy. Democracy is much, much, much deeper than elections, and we won't get into that too much, but it's much deeper than elections. And to make the point, these are the governance indicators that's put together by the World Bank. Six governance indicators, it's probably the most widely used set of indicators around governance. The numbers are a little funny. Zero is the world median on any indicator. Zero is the world, not developing country, world median. Highest number, the numbers are in standard deviations. The highest number goes up to about 2.6, 2.7 standard deviations above the median. The lowest number is about negative 2.7 below the standard, below the world median. So that's what those numbers mean. Most countries are between positive 1 and negative 1. Okay? That's not my point. The point is the change. In every single one of these indicators since 1996, the emerging countries, their governance scores on average have improved, in some cases quite significantly. Whether it's political stability, voice and accountability, regulatory quality, rule of law, government effectiveness, or control of corruption. You see an improvement, fairly dramatic improvement, amongst the 17 emerging countries. When you look at the non-emerging countries in sub-Saharan Africa, on every single one of these indicators of governance, they have gotten worse. And it is these worsening scores that again dominate our thinking of sub-Saharan Africa. That's what makes the newspapers. This does not make. But the point is that it's more than elections. It's an improvement of governance. Still a long way to go, but that's a pretty big change in just a dozen years. Okay, so that's the politics. This is the economics, and I'll go through this a little bit more quickly. 20 years ago, economic policies in sub-Saharan Africa were terrible. Big role for the state, and I'm certainly not one that's always advocating free markets, but the role of the state was far, far, far too big 20 years ago. Major state control over prices, over ownership of supermarkets, drugstores, banks, rural credit unions, marketing boards, all kinds of stuff. And most of those state-owned enterprises were bankrupt and not very effective. Large government budgets, budget deficits, lots of borrowing, high rates of inflation, really quite a mess. This is a measure of anti-growth syndromes. Which combines several economic policies. I won't get into the details of exactly what's in this, but some leading economists put this together under the leadership of Benno Ndulu, who's now the central bank governor of Tanzania, in a book called a two-volume set of economic growth in sub-Saharan Africa. And the economic syndromes, which is a measure of economic policy, mostly disappeared in the emerging countries, but remain pretty bad in the other countries. And there are things in here like overvaluation of exchange rate, import tariffs, which have dropped across the continent, but have dropped much, much more in the emerging countries. Agricultural policies, this is something called the nominal rate of assistance, which is a measure of agricultural policies. Big improvement in agricultural policies in the emerging countries. Not much change in the rest of sub-Saharan Africa. The costs of starting a business in the emerging countries are quite low, much, much lower than they were, and much, much lower than the rest of sub-Saharan Africa, so the business environment is better. So, and there's lots of other economic indicators. But the combination of this political change and this economic change is what drove the turnaround in 1995. And they fed on each other. I do not make an argument that economic change begat political change or that political change begat economic change. And there are a lot of people who try to figure out which one causes the other. I actually think it's just a misguided attempt. I don't think one So I don't think there's any case that you can make that generally over the last 15, 20 years here or in other parts of the world that one drives the other. In fact, I think that they are a self-reinforcing positive cycle. The changes in economic systems and improved economic policies create the space for better political accountability, and the greater the political accountability, the better the economic progress, and on it goes. Whereas, in fact, the previous 20 years, there was a similar reinforcing cycle, but it was negative. That poor governance and poor political systems led to poor economic outcomes, and the worse the economy was, the more the leaders tried to centralize the economic resources into their own hands, which made the political system worse, and you had 20 years of a self-reinforcing negative cycle between economics and politics. Today, I think we have a positive self-reinforcing cycle between economics and politics. So number two is the end of the economic crisis. I've already given you the punchline on this, which is the relationship between the debt crisis and donor relationships. As the debt crisis grew once again, the IMF became front and central, and the debates in sub-Saharan Africa were not about development. They were certainly not about political change. They were about economic stabilization and trying to get the budget and trade deficits under order. And countries lost their ability to really control economic policies, for better or for worse. I think in the long run, actually, in many ways, it helped create some of the foundation for today. But I think also the IMF overplayed their hand many times. But in many ways, broadly speaking, they were pushing, I think, more or less in the right direction. But it was done in some difficult ways that we can talk about that. But the more important point is how much that has changed. IMF stabilization and structural adjustment programs are not at the core of the international debates around these countries anymore. Once they got through debt relief, they needed IMF programs to get debt relief, but most of these countries have gone through the HIPC debt relief process. The debt is off their books. They no longer need the IMF's money because they're back on their feet. They no longer need the IMF's seal of approval for debt relief. So the IMF is playing a supporting role, and I think actually a much more positive role. And the centerpiece of discussions with the international community are now these poverty reduction strategies that countries themselves write. They're ugly, they're not always well written, they're way too long, they're wish lists, there are all kinds of problems. But the countries themselves write these things and approve them, and that is a huge change. And that is creating much more accountability and responsibility for economics and development than existed before. Fourth, and now I'm flipping more towards how this growth was sustained over the last 15 years rather than the turnaround itself, because people ask, well, can this be sustained? This is a fundamental change that I think will help sustain this growth, the rise of technology. Obviously not a big factor in 1995, but will sustain the economic and political progress. Cell phones are absolutely ubiquitous in sub-Saharan Africa, and they are completely fundamentally different there than they are here. Here they are a nice convenience. They're a nice convenience. We have telephones. We used to have telephones that sit on a desk and they had a curly cord with a head handset. You might have seen these in photographs. They actually worked pretty well. And if you wanted to call somebody else who had one of those phones with a curly cord anywhere else in the world, you could make it work. And we also had internet access, which is not yet in sub-Saharan. For us, mobile phones are a great convenience because we can walk around, we can actually be more than 6 feet away from the phone, we can actually be anywhere we want. But it's fundamentally the same thing. In sub-Saharan Africa, it is the difference between being connected and not connected because there weren't landlines. For people in villages in many places in sub-Saharan Africa who are far from roads, are far from phones, are far from anything, the only connection for many people with the outside world was radio. That was it. That was your connection to globalization, to the rest of the world. You had no road, you had nothing. Cell phones connect you immediately. Farmers can find prices. Fishermen coming back from sea can figure out where they want to sell their stuff. Health records can be transmitted. Money can be transmitted. 20 years ago, if you lived in Dar es Salaam and you wanted to get money to Ma, you had to go get the cash, stick it in your pocket or your backpack, hop on a bus, hope that you weren't robbed, many times you were, take a day to get out to Ma, give the money to everybody in the village who saw you getting off the bus, then hop back on the bus and go up to Dar. Take you several days, you'd lose most of the money, Mom would only get a fraction of what you wanted to give her. Today you want to give money to Ma?
pull out your cell phone, punch in a few numbers, and she can go down to the local shop and get that cash in her village. It's safer, it's faster, it's much more effective. So in all kinds of ways, cell phones are just changing. They're creating new economic opportunities. Carpenters don't have to go back to the shop. They can go from one job to the next. People can order supplies for their businesses, changing everything, and is creating new economic opportunities that I think is going to sustain this progress. And as internet connections come along, that's going to make it even bigger. The internet has not been a big player, but it will be. Three new cables have been laid undersea, two off the east coast of Africa, one off the west coast, just in the last couple of years. And as internet connections deepen, we're going to see huge economic and political opportunities coming out of that. And then finally, and I don't have any data here, but I know it's true, there's a whole new generation of leaders across sub-Saharan Africa. Some of them are political leaders, people like Ellen Johnson Sirleaf in Liberia and Nelson Mandela and many others like them that didn't exist a long time ago. But more importantly, in many ways, community leaders, leaders of NGOs, business leaders. And 20 years ago, leadership was in a post-colonial set of leaders that had led countries to independence. Courageous people who had fought against colonialization, had led their countries to independence, and then took over political leadership and business leadership. But that generation didn't work out so well in terms of business and government leadership. That generation is now passing and has gone for the most part, except a few like Robert Mugabe who are still with us. But for the most part, that generation has moved on. And we have a generation today that is not seeped in Cold War ideology, is not seeped in socialism versus communism, is not seeped in the United States versus the Soviet Union, but is seeped in globalization, in being connected to the rest of the world, in using their cell phones, and they are sick and tired of hearing their countries being talked about as the basket cases of the world. And more of those people are going back to their countries and making a change at their local level. And for me, that's the biggest change going forward, and that's what's going to sustain it. And many of you, I'm sure, can just think of four or five people that you know in sub-Saharan Africa. And you know exactly who I'm talking about, who's leading the local NGO, who's starting their own business, who's gone to work in the Ministry of Finance, is trying to be a member of parliament, an opposition candidate. And that didn't exist 20 years ago, and it does now. And I think that gives me more confidence than anything else that these political and economic changes are going to continue in at least this set of countries. Let me stop there. And open it up for questions.
All right, so we'll let you take the questions. We'll have about 15 to 20 minutes for questions, and I want to let everybody know that after this session, there will be some lunch, some sandwiches available in the large corner area, and hope that you'll take that as an occasion to further discuss these issues among yourselves. So, please.
Questions, yeah.
Hi. I actually kind of have two. One is income inequality. I wondered if you could speak a little bit about income inequality within the countries. And you made several comments in terms of in the before period, if you looked at Botswana, if you looked at a couple of countries about how much they would skew things, or just grow your curve.
Yep.
And I wonder how much that is still the case. I look at a couple of the countries you list, such as Mali, such as Burkina Faso, and I know that they have appeared at the very bottom of the UNDP's Human Development Index.
Yep.
For the last 10 or 20 years, they're right there in the bottom five, maybe longer.
Yep.
And so I wonder, as I look at that, you know, Mali is kind of that great story of the democracy without development.
Yep. So all good questions. So on income inequality, which I didn't show, just because I can't show everything, basically the numbers using the Gini coefficient are showing not much change one way or the other. So whether that's good news or bad news, take your pick. I think basically it's good news. It is not the case that this growth is leading towards greater economic concentration, or at least there's no real evidence in the Gini coefficient for what that's worth, and other measures of inequality, of course, you know, no measures of inequality are particularly good, but there's no sign that it's getting worse, and I think that's consistent with the poverty numbers and the agriculture numbers. If you thought that there was widespread economic concentration, you wouldn't see the poverty numbers falling, and it would be unusual to see the agriculture sector growing. Because it is growing, that suggests
doesn't necessarily mean, but it suggests that a lot of poor people are experiencing something. So the indicators that I have are at least that income distribution is not getting worse. So on Botswana and Mauritius, they, in the 80s, where am I? In the 80s, they were a big part of this difference. And I, as I pointed out, if you take out Mauritius and Botswana, this line drops here. After 1995, they're both above the line a little bit, but they don't skew it all that much. And their growth rates are high. Botswana is high, and Mauritius is 3.7, but the 4.1 and 3.7, but the average here is now 3.2. So they're a little above the average. Yeah, they bring it up, but they don't really, you wouldn't see, you don't, as I've done that, and you don't see a lot of, it doesn't change the underlying story. It's a little bit lower, yeah, but it doesn't change the underlying story. Now, you're right, on some of these countries, Burkina and others, remain quite poor. My focus here is on changes since the mid-90s, and a lot of these countries remain very, very poor, with terrible development indicators, very low incomes, very high poverty rates. That's true. What this suggests is that things have begun to change, even for those countries, since the mid-1990s. Now, for Burkina, that's not a very high growth rate. It's going to take a long time to make a lot of progress, but that growth rate is a whole lot better than the negative growth rate that prevailed in Burkina Faso for the previous 20 years. So it's the change from a negative per capita to 2.8% positive. Still take a long time before that's going to show up in a lot of the UNDP indicators and other places, but at least it's a start, and they're not getting any worse. And that's true with a lot of the other countries as well. So it remains bad. It remains tough, but at least the change is underway. Next. Yes, Neil.
Hi, good afternoon. What impact, if any, has the influx of money from China affected either emerging and helping them grow or other countries and keeping them stagnant?
Yeah, it's a good question. And the last chapter of the book is forward-looking and talks about that. China is not too much behind this story because they weren't really active until the last 4 or 5 years. I think they probably have influence in the last 4 or 5 years, but certainly not the last 15. So I leave the discussion about China in the last chapter in terms of the forward looking. It's a complicated question. I think overall the impact of China in the emerging countries has been positive. I say in the emerging countries, because I think there are some of the other countries in sub-Saharan Africa where the impact has not been so great. Overall, China, and I should be clear, China is the big driver, but there's a lot of money coming in from India, from Indonesia, Malaysia, lots of other countries. China is really big for obvious reasons, but it's not just China. Even Brazil, lots of investment from Brazil now coming into West Africa as well. It's great new sources of finance. There's a lot of infrastructure investment going on, building roads and power stations, all kinds of good stuff. And in many ways, it's quite good. There's a couple of big risks. One is the obvious political risk that this, in some ways, might allow countries, governments of countries, to to go back towards really poor governance, dictatorship, or corruption. And the other main argument or concern is that it will lead to Dutch disease, or concentration of natural resources, and very much extractive. The Chinese get all the benefits, not much local. I think both of those are absolutely legitimate, spot-on concerns. The bottom line is, my view is that I am seeing differences again in how contractual relationships with China are being engaged in with the emerging countries, the democracies, and the non-democracies. It's far from perfect, but where countries have said, here are the standards, we have open bidding, competitive bidding, and we've got to publish the results, the Chinese firms have said, sure, we'll do that. In countries where the message is the winner is the person who provides the fattest envelope, they say, sure, we'll do that too. So, for example, in Liberia, where I spent a lot of time, the Chinese firms were more than happy to compete in open bidding processes.
and have been overall a positive impact. In other countries, not so great. There's been a lot of pushback in Zambia, employing more Chinese workers than locals. So this is a complicated question. It's a hugely important question. But I think, again, it's important to keep in mind these distinctions between how this would play out in a democracy that is trying to move towards more accountability and transparency than not. And I think the bottom line is to engage the Chinese government as much as possible, to try to get them to endorse agendas around the countries have put forward, not that we're putting forward, but the countries have put forward in terms of transparency, accountability, competitiveness, and openness. And if we can get agreement on those principles, we'll get a long way towards towards making sure that net the benefits are positive. Thanks.
My name is Matthew Bruce, and I'm with the U.S. International Trade Commission. Thank you for a very compelling presentation. One factor we haven't talked about at all is regional economic integration, and I'm wondering whether groupings such as the East African Community or SADC.
Yeah.
To what extent are they important or irrelevant for the story thus far and going forward?
Right. Well, I'm glad there's only one thing that I haven't talked about. regional economic integration, the place where it has played a huge role is in the southern continent around South Africa. There's no question in my mind that one of the big reasons for Mozambique's success over the last 15 years is that they're right next door to South Africa, and there's a lot of economic integration, including their power pool. Mozambique generates a lot of hydro up in the north and sends it into the South African grid and then actually re-imports some of that power off the South African grid to power Maputo, among other places. So there's that kind of stuff. So, you know, for Mozambique, you know, Botswana, still a lot of people ask the question, how has Botswana been so successful as a landlocked country, one of the few landlocked countries? Because they've been so deeply integrated with South Africa for a long, 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 long time. And the diamonds and the cattle and the other stuff that's going on in Botswana, they can export out through the South African market. So at that level, I think regional integration has been a big deal. And the formal institution in the southern area has been the South African Customs Union, SACU, which has been around since 1910, I think, or 1908 or something longer. Now, other than that, I don't think regional stuff has had much role. I don't think SADC has played, frankly, much role for the East African Community. Maybe now in its new reinvigorated life, the East African Community started up in the 70s, like late 60s and 70s, between Tanzania and Kenya and Uganda, and then collapsed, and now it's been reinvigorated with Burundi and Rwanda joining. There's some talk about South Sudan joining. You know, I'm all for it, go for it. But it has not been a big part, and I have my doubts going forward I worry sometimes that those debates quickly get into the institutional forms around the East African Community or around ECOWAS rather than the actual economic integration themselves. What you need for integration is the roads to connect Tanzanian farmers with Zambian markets and vice versa, and for power grids to be integrated and the West African power pool to come together. And when these regional groups get together, they often debate about who's getting what money and, you know, tariff rates, and stuff, which are not the big issues. So there's a lot of integration that's beginning to go to happen. In Tanzania, the Southern Agricultural Growth Board is an example, but not through the institutions. So that's kind of how I would address that. Yes, way in the back.
Hi, thanks very much. I'm Mark Carroll, a fellow at the Stimson Center. I just wonder if you could expand a little more on the correlations between demographics and economic growth.
Yeah.
I mean, you showed a slide where there's an increase in fertility rates and increase in economic growth. Expectation based on a number of African countries that fertility rates will stay high in the coming decades and how that might impact chance for growth.
Right. So this is the population growth rates, it's not fertility rates. But the fertility rates are actually showing a similar pattern. And I just showed one rather than both. So we have the beginning of this change. I don't venture, I'm not an economic demographer, I'm no expert in demography. So I don't venture too deeply into this. But other than to really say I was stunned actually when I came up with this graph and found out that the patterns had really changed at the same time that the economies had begun to change. So what's behind that, I'm not enough of an economic demographer to get out on a limb and say. But I do think that these are deeply intertwined, both the economic side and, frankly, the political side. And by the political side, I mean a lot of this, the end of conflict, which I showed, the drop in conflict. And I suspect that as the economies and political systems began to stable, and that one of the characteristics of that was the drop in conflict, that may have led to changes in people's decisions about fertility. I don't know, but I suspect that the end of conflicts in most of these countries played a role in that. So where this is going to go, I don't know. But if it does play out, and if it does turn out to be the beginning of a turnaround, of a demographic turnaround, all of that is just going to help sustain economically what's going on in the generations to come. If we begin to see fertility rates drop even further, women having fewer children, and that should pan out in terms of dependency ratios and a better economic turn. But it's too early to say much more about it. And for people who are real demographers, I would invite you to jump in and start doing some analysis on this and see if there's something happening. Yes, over here.
Hi.
Bias to one side. Come back to this side of the room. Go ahead.
Hi, my name is Awa, and at the beginning of the presentation, someone mentioned Mali and Burkina Faso, like smaller countries in West Africa. I'm wondering if in your study you've looked into individual countries to see what's preventing them from taking the extra step to reach the next level.
To which country? Burkina and Mali or the other?
Yeah, or just some of the countries in this list of 17 emerging countries.
But just to be clear, are you asking about the Burkina and Mali, which are in this group? Or are you asking about this group and what's presenting?
No, emerging countries.
In the emerging countries, what's presenting?
Yes.
So, before I answer, I have a question for you, which is where are you from? From Burkina. It's always good to know before it's from. So, I know nothing about Burkina. But let me jump into that anyway. Having said that I know nothing about it, let me try and answer. Burkina and Mali and other countries that in that region of West Africa face huge geographic constraints. The fact that they are landlocked and so arid, they start with two big strikes against them. I'm not a believer that geography determines economic outcomes in a huge way, but it matters a lot. There's a reason why coastal areas develop first and inland areas develop later. There's a reason why places that get more and more predictable rainfall do a lot better than places that either get wild fluctuations in rainfall or very little rainfall at all. And the two major vehicles through which most countries in the world have developed over the last 200 years since the Industrial Revolution are really through agricultural development and exporting manufacturers of consumer goods, of labor-intensive goods, shoes and gadgets and toys and games. And in many ways, that's what happened between the United States and Europe, a lot of trade early on, and of course with the rise of East Asia over the last 20 years. To follow one of those two routes, you need rainfall and good soils, and you need a coast. And the landlocked countries of West Africa don't have either. So the deck is stacked against them. And it's not just there, it's other places in the world too. Afghanistan is one of the greatest development challenges we face today, even if there wasn't an enormous war and security issues going on. And it faces many of the same constraints as do the other landlocked countries of that region of the world. So it's very tough. And one of the few landlocked countries that have done well is Botswana, but it had diamonds that it managed well, and it was really deeply integrated into the South African economy. So I think the way forward, not that I have any silver bullets at all, because people have not figured out exactly what those are, but investing in agriculture and trying to make it as productive as possible, especially in the face of climate change, because it's going to make that challenge going forward. Even though agriculture can only take you so far, investments in agriculture, I think, are key. And then second, whatever can be done to integrate the economies into the rest of the world. Now, I said that a little bit vaguely. The classic way to do that is through roads. The rates of return on road construction are very high, good investments, but the costs are huge. They cost a lot of money, and it's very hard for countries to pay for it. It's very hard for donors to pay for it. We have the Millennium Challenge Corporation, which is building some roads in Mali. But that's the classic way to become integrated. The internet and cell phones provide new ways to become integrated to markets, which provide opportunities that didn't before. Uganda, for example, has done quite well. And airplanes is the third. That's the internet, cell phones, and airplanes provide three new technologies, if you will, that allow countries to integrate with global markets that didn't exist 20 or 30 years ago. So Uganda exports flowers, for example. They have these wonderful, and so does Kenya, they have these wonderful greenhouses in Entebbe in Uganda near the airport. They grow these great flowers and they ship them off, and the next day they're sold in Rotterdam or other places. They're going through a little bit of a tough time at the moment because of the economic crisis. But the point is that they're integrating with global markets. Cell phones and the internet allow people to do data entry, for example, or call centers. You've all been on call phones. Those are ways to integrate workers into the global marketplace. And we've done this over hundreds of years through technologies, ships, roads, now it's airplanes, cell phones, and the internet. So it's tough, but I think we have, with these new technologies, ways forward. And the key, so you can't ignore the road, you got to do the roads, and the key for Burkina and Mali is to find neighbors that are also stable, where you can build that regional integration, which we were talking about earlier, to get that stuff through the road network back and forth. But it's tough. So that's only a partial answer. So a couple more questions over here, and then we'll wrap up. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So Mike Moore from George Washington University. So at least the choices of democratic system in a country is ultimately made by the people the country itself. Yep. Economic policies, although affected by IMF and World Bank, perhaps, ultimately, in a sustained fashion, made by the by the countries themselves. Let me ask you, not as a spokesperson for the U.S. government, what role do U.S. policies have in making a difference in these countries, or does it play a critical role?
Right.
Supporting role?
Well, if I thought
how important
it,
is it?
Even not speaking for the U.S. government, if I thought it played no role, I would not be working for USAID. So obviously I think it has some role. A couple things on that. One, what's at the heart of your question is a question about sustainability. And one thing I haven't said, but I'll take the opportunity to say it now, I'm fairly optimistic about the progress for these countries as a whole, as a group, going forward. That's not to say that I would bet on each and every one of them continuing to succeed. Development is a really, really tough, tough process. And I would guess that 20 years from now, some of the countries here might fall off the list. Others might join. Had I done this 5 or 6 years ago, by the way, Madagascar might have been on the list. But the list changes a little bit. I'm pretty bullish, for the most part, that there will be some exceptions. The three countries that I am most worried about are the non-democracies, Ethiopia, Rwanda, and Uganda, because they don't have the strong systems of accountability yet. They might, and frankly, I'll give Rwanda a little bit of a pass, given the history of genocide. It takes time. But they don't have those systems of accountability yet. And in the absence of those systems of accountability, and in the absence of a transition to another government that will sustain these policies, and none of those three have had a political transition yet, I worry, because all of the progress that they've made could collapse in Uganda when Museveni finally does step down or go or whatever. If it turns out that there's no transition process in place, you could easily descend into chaos. So that's not exactly your question, but I wanted to take advantage of saying that. I think we in the U.S. government can play, and other donors can play, a couple of roles. One is that to support, obviously, the political and economic changes underway by giving those countries more of the lead than we would in these countries. In other words, we need to distinguish our approach
and how we work with these countries different from how we work with these countries. In these countries, I want them in the lead. I want them to come up with an economic strategy. If they need some advice, we can help them, but it's their strategy through their system. And as long as it's kind of reasonable, we're not going to second guess every detail. We'll support it. And we'll give more money, a little harder to say these days, but we hope to give more money over a longer period of time. We'll make a commitment for 5-6 years. We'll bet on these horses, and we'll give them, you know, we'll make a kind of a longer term bet. These guys, no, sorry, Zimbabwe, no, I'm not letting Robert Mugabe tell me where we're investing U.S. dollars in Zimbabwe. These countries, I'm sorry, I'm not a big follower of government-led programs in these countries. I don't think that's where we should be investing. We could be investing in those countries outside of governments through NGOs and other effective groups. We're not going to get much progress on economic growth, frankly. To put it simply, here I think we have to focus more on providing, helping to pay for basic services, schools and clinics and stuff, working through NGOs. Probably not long-term growth, because it's not going to happen. And I would keep these folks, to the extent we do provide financing, on a much shorter leash, 1 year at a time, 2 years at a time. So here, more money, more control by the local government, longer commitments. And here, just the opposite. So I would make those distinctions. I think here we can play a role in helping to support a further economic and political change by not being too heavy-handed. I actually think by backing off a little bit and being supportive, we can go a lot further. And I've seen this in countries where, to the extent that, you know, we have a difference of opinion on a major economic policy, if we're willing to say, okay, we disagree with you on this, but we respect you as the leaders of this country, and you've heard us, and it's your call, then we are actually, in many ways, in a stronger position to influence the next decision, because we're seen as reasonable and a good partner, and not just forcing them down. And I see that more and more, where we'll make our opinions known, we'll say what we believe, but we are more willing to say, you know, your country, you've done a great job over the last 15 years, and we're gonna bet on it. And that makes us a better partner. So we can provide some money, we can provide some policy advice, and we can support not just governments, but non-government organizations as well, which I think in the long run are central to sustaining a lot of this stuff. So we do a lot of work in these countries through NGOs as well, some of which the governments don't particularly like, but that's okay. Last question, one more.
Yeah, thank you so much. Thank you for your presentation. I'm John. I'm working at the Radio Free Asia, also the GW student. You mentioned the North Korea at the beginning of your presentation as an example. So North Korea has the same situation and conditions, dictatorship, their hunger, and
it's a lot worse, but go ahead.
So I think the 17 emerging countries can be a good role model to North Korea to give to put information and implication on that. Mm-hmm. So I'd like to ask you about how do you look at the North Korea situation economically, and what's your suggestion to the North Koreans?
Well, I have to admit, in all the times I've given a presentation on the Africa book, this is the first time I've been asked on North Korea. And I only know a little bit about North Korea, and I have no idea, you know, what the prescription is. But I will pick up on your first point. I think you're absolutely right that these countries can be a model for other countries in transition. When that transition happens in North Korea, I have no idea. And you have no reason to believe whatever I would say on that. But I do believe that someday a transition will happen. And when that transition happens, if there's a good government that comes in, they will be looking for economic models. And they won't, you know, they'll listen to the IMF or the World Bank or the US government, but far more powerful are other low-income countries that have been in that situation that can be examples for them. And I'll give you two examples of why I believe that so much. When I worked in Indonesia and was an advisor to the Indonesian government, they were constantly asking me, what did Malaysia do on this set of issues? What did South Korea do on this set of issues? What did Thailand do? They didn't care what the United States did. They didn't care what Great Britain did in 1820. They didn't care about Europe. They didn't care about that stuff. They wanted to know what Malaysia and Thailand and Singapore and Hong Kong and South Korea had done. And if that's what they did, that's what they were doing. They didn't care if it was free market or socialist or government-led. They looked at the successful countries and they modeled it after. In Liberia, more recently where I've worked, President Sirleaf is constantly asking, what did Ghana do? What did Mozambique do when it came out of its conflict? What did Uganda do when it came out of its conflict? Because Uganda, you know, Liberia went through a terrible 15-year civil war, but Uganda went through a long, awful, terrible war in the 70s and early 80s, and so did Mozambique. And for her, it was much more powerful to find out the examples of what other countries had done. So I think when North Korea does turn to look at these countries that were very poor, had everything against them, had poor political systems, but managed to make some changes that led to good progress, I think those would be a powerful example. And I also think, just to extend that one last point, that these countries, one of the powerful pieces of these countries is that they will be examples for these countries when the time comes for these to turn. Cote d'Ivoire now has a group of countries in West Africa, Ghana, Liberia, Mali, and others to connect to that have gone, Sierra Leone, that have gone through this and provide models and places where they can integrate to. And, you know, as countries here come along, they now have a group of other countries where they can follow, and no one's telling them follow South Korea, which doesn't make much sense if you're Liberia. Follow Ghana makes a lot of sense if you're Liberia. Follow South Korea does not. And so one of the larger that group becomes, the more powerful a force it will be for the rest of the continent to follow their lead over time, I think. So let me finish right there. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Extremely interesting. I want to first let everybody know that if you go to the IIEP webpage under today's event, you'll find a link to this book where you can find out more about it and buy a copy and explore this in a lot more detail.